Go ahead and have a seat. We are here this morning for a rules hearing. It is 2106, the amendment of SCR Chapter 68 relating to court security, facilities, and staffing. I understand we have one presenter this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard that isn't on my list? Are you okay?
Where do you think my glasses are?
I wondered if that was a... So glasses. That happens. That happens. That's easy to solve. I like problems like that. That's easy. I thought, uh-oh, what happened? What did I do wrong? Okay, so we have one presenter. Anyone else like to be heard this morning? Okay. All right. Judge Boren, if you would, please.
Thank you and good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Ziegler and other members of the court to other court staff that's present. I'm Judge Mike Boren. I'm a circuit judge in Waukesha County, and I'm also chairman of the PPAC Subcommittee on Court Security. And our committee was assigned the task of reviewing and making proposed changes to Supreme Court Rule Chapter 68 on Court Security and Safety, and I'm coming forward with our report for that. I want to begin by recognizing members of our committee. They're published in the petition and in the memorandum that we filed with the court, but it's important that everyone, from my perspective, know who was on the committee and the hard work that they did. The committee functioned from 2006. The members were Judge Andy Voigt from Columbia County, Sally Ann Danner, court commissioner from Fond du Lac, James Brigham, a deputy sheriff here in Dane County, Carol Jeske, Racine County's superintendent of building and grounds, Mike Nyman, the District 3 court administrator, Attorney Bill Weigel from the Department of Office of Lawyer Regulation. He's also a municipal judge in Middleton. And, of course, Ann Olson was our staff person. Myself, with regard to Sally Ann Danner, and as well as Carl Jeske and Bill Weigel, all served on the committee in 2011 and proposed a 2011 petition that resulted in Court Rule 68. I want to extend a special thanks to Mike Nyman as well as Jim Brigham and Ann Olson for really the hard work that they did in giving us advice and keeping the committee moving. Ann was terrific in keeping us on task, giving us ideas, giving us insight. So it was just excellent. We first met on May 10, 2016, and we continued to meet to 2021. During that time, we had some outside contact. We had Bill Rafferty from the National Council of State Courts that came in to talk about trends in security and staffing, security and safety, room sizes. We had Ron Locast, who was an architect with Potter Larson, come in and talk about courtroom design and how to lay out courtrooms, room sizes, and so forth. We met with Adam Plotkepkin and Jennifer Bias from the State Public Defender's Office to talk to us really about the impact of court safety and security on their ability to see their clients in the county jail, how security can have somewhat of a negative impact on that. I met with the State Bar Association last year with regard to the proposed rule, and they had representatives from the state bar at various meetings that the committee conducted. We also reviewed a federal publication that the U.S. courts put out that's a design guide for courthouses. It's really a big publication, and it has a lot of ideas about designs, courtroom sizes, layouts, how to handle security and safety. Our final product is really the collective mindset of the members of the committee using our collective knowledge as well as experience as committee members and as judges and people involved in the court system. What I'd like to do is present now about the rule. I'll do it in four sections. I'll first review Chapter 68's history. I'll then look at how it's organized. I'll look at some key amendments. And then I'll have some brief comments about what the future holds. The common guiding public policy throughout the Rule 68 and its predecessor, 70.39 in Chapter 70, was really to coordinate management of court facility and issues between the courts, the county officials, and their respective staffs. It recognizes the dichotomy between the state funding of court proceedings as well as the county management of the facilities. Because you have to remember that judges and court reporters now are paid by the state, but everything else is provided by the counties. Pencils, erasers, papers, everything. It also looks at the, takes into account the constitutional responsibility of the Supreme Court in addressing facilities and court staffing. The rule works to really harmonize the construction and management and operation of court facilities. In looking at how the rule is organized, I see that it's divided into five parts, and so I'll be discussing those five parts. First section is the Security and Facilities Committee. That's it's set forth in the rule with various people who should be assigned to it by functions. Circuit judge is the chair. Committee meets quarterly. The committee has a function in every county that's essential. It's really a forum to discuss security and safety and to do it with all of the opinion makers. The people on the committee should be the opinion makers of the county, county executive, county administrator, judges, the facilities people, people from the county board. It has representatives of the Bar Association as well as the public defender. The committee, what's interesting about the committee, we have all these opinion makers, and in my experience, they always show up at every quarterly meeting, but we have no real authority. Our authority is to bring people together, talk about issues, and lay out programs that then are hopefully adopted by the county administration and by the entire court system. The committee determines general security and facilities policies that then are hopefully enforced by the county and by the various governmental bodies. In 68.05, there's 23 separate policy issues we recommend that the committee look at. I'm chairman of the Waukesha Committee, and I use those policy issues as part of my agenda. Each quarterly meeting, I take three or four, and we bring the county people in that reference those to see what's doing, what's happening, so we know that everybody's on their toes and they're doing what they can. Another part of the responsibility in the setting forth the rule is the construction and design of new and remodeled facilities. The rule actually gets very specific in places as to what sizes it should be, size of the bench, height of the bench, views of the bench, what the judge has as far as things at his fingertips or her, as well as her fingertips. It certainly addresses court entrances, courthouse entrances, sectoring, all those things are dealt with in the part addressing construction and facilities. We look at auxiliary facilities as well, issues with regard to jury rooms, jury boxes, how they should be set up, court commissioner courtrooms. Another part of the rule addresses various staffing issues, first within the judicial setting, the judicial assistant, law clerks, aides, court reporters, and also the security personnel, how many bailiffs should be at the courthouse in each courtroom, how we should staff the entrance to courthouses with safety and security staff. Then there's a fifth section that addresses the director of state courts. And with regard to the director of state courts, the director becomes a repository for various reports on safety and security throughout the operation of the court system and should be a base for information as well as a storage of data with regard to what's happening throughout the state. With regard to modification of the rule, I want to just address some specific parts. I'm not going to address everything we've done, but some ones that I feel are important. In the beginning of the rule, in section 68.01 sub 4, there's a new section that's in the rule, and it's there to state that all court facilities should be designed and maintained to support safety and security. In the past, we talked about safety and security issues, height of benches, sectoring, all of that, but we never said you really have to focus on court security and safety across the board, and not only for facilities, but for staffing as well, for the judges, for the court staff, as well as the public, as what can be safe for them. And you have to design things, remodel things, keeping that situation in mind.
Judge Bourne, can I ask you a question regarding that? First of all, thank you for putting all this together and being here today. I'd like to know what committees you're not on. Because it seems
well, there
like
are a number of them. Thank you.
Every time I turn around, you're serving on another committee, so thank you.
You're welcome.
What I'm curious about is, what about some of the older courthouses? And I'm curious as to what kind of recommendations you are making. You just talked about remodeling. And I know, you know, around the state, there's some newer courthouses. I was here in Dane County, which is relatively new, but there are some older. There's some counties where they might have the funds to be able to retrofit them, and some that there aren't as much the funds to do that. So I'm just wondering if the committee had any recommendations for older courthouses that would need significant remodeling.
Well, that's really the key to the rule is flexibility. The rule doesn't require that a courthouse or the courthouse be built, then are remodeled in any particular way, but it recommends what should be done. So the older courthouses, that it would be impossible to do some of the things in the rule. The rule is flexible enough, you do what you can to make it safe. Instance, the sectoring is an issue. That is, you should have security at the entrance to the courthouse.
Okay.
You should have a way to keep inmates separate, the people that are being transported in custody, separate from the public. And in the best of all worlds, you have to be able to keep us, the judges, the court staff, separate from frankly, the public as well as the inmates. New courthouses do that. Old courthouses can still do some of those things, even to the extent of having a separate place to park and a separate door for the court staff to come in. So it can be done. And the flexibility in the rule isn't something that's new. This is something that has been in the rule since 1995. Because really, the rule recognizes there's a lot of different things out there, different buildings, different attitudes, 72 counties with probably 72 different approaches and ideas of what to do with the judges. As you might recognize, some counties, which is assume we not be there. On the other hand, it is the courthouse. So we have to be able to address that, as well as those counties that sort of wrap their arms around the courts and really do an excellent job of taking care of us.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to follow up on that question.
Sure, go ahead.
I was going to wait until you got to 68, I guess, point 13, but a follow-up is this. Over the years, the issue of court remodeling and court building has been a significant issue in some counties. Indeed, especially in rural counties, you know, it's all a matter of, I say like this, money, right?
Mr. Green, as we say.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
I said Mr. Green.
That's right, Mr. Green. And in looking at this and following up just Justice Crossley's question, I'm reminded of counties like Jackson County many years ago, or better yet, Lincoln County. There is flexibility with regard to remodeling older courthouses, but we also, as a court system, as I see it, have a hammer, and have had a hammer in the past, and I want to make sure that this rule does not in any way diminish our hammer, and I don't think that it does. Judge Moore up in the 9th District, Lincoln County was the best example, took them 14 years, and they were under court order from the Chief Judge, Judge Moore, to do specifically remodeling, if I recall, and I took a look at some of this within the last couple of days. He issued an order requiring them to expedite planning and building. You know, in rural counties, this is such a substantial issue dealing with old courthouses, historic courthouses, as we have so many in this state, that county board supervisors sometimes lose their jobs. So it looks to because of the way they vote on remodeling or new, and it looks to me that we still have that hammer as a court system in 68, I guess it is, 03 now, remodeling, construction, or relocation of court facilities.
Is that 68.03?
I think so.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I see that we still have, in sub 4, the chief judge has to approve it, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
And the real hammer, sometimes used as a threat, I remember this was a huge controversy during Lincoln County, and our director of state courts had to go up there several times. Sub 5, no circuit judge or court staff may occupy a new remodeled or relocated court facility until it is approved by the chief judge. So that's a real hammer that the court system
Absolutely.
Has had over the years, and I think an essential hammer that it retains. I noticed you played around in the edges of this in terms of what record the director of state courts has to take, but there's still very much a hammer if we ever need it. Am I correct
yes,
on that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Good.
And
you.
It's been the most recent situation that I'm aware of is Walworth County. It's probably about 10 years ago or so that there's some real issues. And it was clear that unless the issues were remedied, and it had to do with actually removing the floor and doing some other things, some rather major changes, the courts weren't going to occupy the courthouse. I think it was the courthouse addition. And the rule came into play then. So it's there. It's really a great balancing. The county controls the money. To an extent, the county controls the planning as well because they hire the architects, the construction managers, and so forth. But the courts have to have input into that. And that's part of us. The situation might be more informal. It has to do with the personalities involved, I think, most of the time. But you have to be able to have the county look at the judiciary as a separate branch of government, not as a department of the county. Once you've crossed that bridge, then you're able to have a good conversation. But they know that the chief judge is always there, and certainly every county that's been involved in serious construction issues makes sure that the county knows that. And I think it's worked successfully.
Lincoln County took 14 years. I have copies of the minutes of 2012, and it says, after a 14-year struggle, Lincoln County has now decided what they're going to do. So sometimes it takes a little while.
Oh, no, I understand that. There are a lot, as you know, there's just many different personalities involved in these type of activities, and you have to be able to address those.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. In looking at some of the other issues that address the amendments, one we put into a comment, but it really addresses this issue that the Security and Facilities Committee is a court committee and not subject to the open meeting laws or the open records laws. There are Supreme Court decisions that go back in, I think it's 71 with second, that talk about the Supreme Court committees being separate and then being exempt from those rules. We have to, there are some counties that they have a lot of pushback with the committee, and we wanted to put this in the rules so that our judges and chair of the local committees understand that they don't have to have a public meeting. They don't have to post its time and meeting. So that's now specifically in the rule.
Judge Morin, can I address that,
sure.
that issue for a minute? And again, reiterate thanks for all the great work on this rule. In the response to the comments, the main authority that was cited was the Lynch versus Dancy case.
At 71?
Yes. No, 1976, I think. So that case had to do with the creation of rules and procedures for the Judicial Commission. And the court The kind of logic of the opinion is basically the Supreme Court has authority over judicial discipline. That authority is exclusive, and the creation of rules of procedure and a body called the Judicial Commission as well are derivations of that authority that are within that's exclusive, can't be overridden by, the open meetings law in particular in that context. I don't see anything in this opinion that addresses something as broad as is stated in your proposed addition. I understand the idea that it's we'd like to give maybe comfort to people who are addressing sensitive matters, but I don't see anything in the opinion that says all committees created by this court are generally speaking exempt from open meetings law. The rationale of the opinion was very much tied to our superintending control over, constitutionally granted over courts and the personnel within them. But I don't know how far that extends out to things like security, which is very much a cooperative venture, may or may not be exclusive or within our control in the same way that we've held judicial discipline proceedings are. Or discipline of attorneys, for that matter, which is something we've also said is exclusive and under our control. So I guess I wanted to raise that issue to you. I get hesitant about going farther than we need to or saying more than we've said, particularly on something like this. If there is some other authority that says that when we create a committee, it's generally not subject to open meetings, that may be true. I don't know the answer to those questions. Those are, could potentially be legal issues. It might depend on the content. And again, at least based upon this reasoning, I think the question would be something that's sort of uniquely within the province of the superintending control that has been given to the Wisconsin Supreme Court under the Constitution. Any thoughts on that?
I do. Putting aside the issue of safety and security and the need to maintain confidentiality on some of those issues, the matter came up specifically in Winnebago County in 2017. The Attorney General issued an opinion with regard to that issue and found by analogy that based upon the reasoning in the Dancy case, the Lynch case, that you're able to move forward and apply it to the Security and Facilities Committee with a proviso that addresses county board members and might be present in issues with regard to a floating or a walking quorum that can create for their committees. But when Marsha Vandercook was still with the courts, I actually think she's back, but she wrote a memorandum on June 20, 2017. That's part of the listing of memorandums on the Director of State Courts website that addresses this very issue and uses that and finds that there's authority for maintaining the exemption for the Security and Facilities Committee. It's somewhat based upon an Attorney General letter opinion, July 26, 2016, that addresses the issue. So that's the authority that the committee relied upon to take the position that it did. Plus, frankly, the committee took the position on a common sense basis that if we're talking about weaknesses, which is often the issue at meetings, weaknesses and the defenses of the courthouse for safety and security, we frankly don't want to make that public. Now, that's a common sense approach, but we need authority for it. And using the analogy, using the Lynch case as a foundation, and perhaps others, and then looking at what the Attorney General did as well as Marsha Vandercook's analysis, we've relied upon that.
How critical is that piece in your view? You said you were getting some, that there's been pushback over over issues of open meetings, and so this was trying to give a little oomph to people pushing back against that pushback.
Pushback might not have been the right way to say it. What happens typically, and it's happened to me, that the county executive office says, Mike, we have to publish notice for your committee. And, of course, and I say we don't, and I give them the authority, and it moves on. But it bounces back in that way. If sometimes it comes up in an adversarial situation where someone isn't happy with what's going on, they want to try and undermine the authority of the committee. But it's if you look at the, and I wasn't, and I haven't briefed out the Lynch case and all these different applications to it. But in my reading of the of Marsh's memorandum, reading of the Lynch case and of the Attorney General's letter, I'm satisfied that it's good public policy to take the rationale in Lynch and apply it to a committee like the Security and Facilities Committee, and to maintain safety and security for the court staff and the court operation as something that's somewhat sacred, if you will, that's important. It's not simply a public relations operation. It's real important issues that go to safety and security, which in some respects have to be maintained in a confidential manner.
Other than, are there other ways of handling it other than the invocation of our exclusive constitutional authority? That is a hammer, and it's a big claim. It might be right. It might be. That's a big claim. To think that our exclusive supervisory authority extends down to county security facilities. It might be right. I just haven't thought through that all the way. The comment suggests that it does. And again, I understand the argument there. Are there other ways of achieving the goal besides invocation of of the Constitution?
I haven't discovered one to keep that keeps in confidence, if you will, the type of things that we talk about. Now, at every meeting, we don't talk about real sensitive matters, but they can come up, and at some meetings, the whole meeting is about what I call very sensitive matters. I look at these issues as similar to issues of collective bargaining that governmental bodies deal with. When the governmental body meets to discuss collective bargaining, they do it in a closed meeting. But the meeting's noticed. That's perhaps the big distinction there. But otherwise, the type of things that we do on the security and facilities are internal matters that are really fairly internal and tightly controlled.
I don't disagree with that as a policy matter at all. Does current law sort of allow that or protect that, though? I mean, I and other positions participated in meetings dealing with security threats that were not open to the public. And I guess I haven't looked at this exact question, but I presume that the open meetings law accommodates the idea that something that's dealing with, you know, confidential security issues, we're talking about the safety and security of public officials and, you know, those folks could already be protected under the law.
That is a view. I just take the severed view. I take it a step further that it's the type of issue that's somewhat unique. I used a collective bargaining example, but it's different. It's different than collective bargaining. It's really more sensitive. It somewhat goes to the core of how we operate to be able to be safe and secure, especially in today's climate and the climate that's been around for a number of years. But there's dangerous things going on, and dangerous things relative to the court system, as well as generally speaking. So I think we have to be very careful about it and use good discretion. So my discretion is to maintain the confidentiality, if you will, of the meetings and notices.
Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Anything else you'd like to discuss?
I can. What I'm going to do is just move to some thoughts for the future. I had some other issues to bring up, but I can use those at a later date. Things to look at in the future for the operation of the rule. One is flexibility. The rule is flexible. It maintains that flexibility. It really helps us to meet any kind of challenge that comes up in any type of courthouse, in any type of county. I think we have to do more on training, and the rule talks about emphasizing training. and getting people trained and doing it on a regular basis and reporting that training, usually up to the director of state courts. We need to develop policies and procedures to look at specific challenges to the residences of judges, court staff, court commissioners, and things that go on outside of the courthouse. You have to keep in mind that the courthouses tend to be safe. We have police and sheriffs there. But the judges who have been at risk most recently have been at their houses. We have to do things to instill some residential security, institutionalize that type of training. We need to do more. I think we need a permanent committee on court safety and security to continue to monitor not only the rule, but the situation. We need, too, to reinstitutionalize the annual court safety and security conference to the extent that we require judges to attend at least once every term, just like we do the criminal law and sentencing conference. I think that's a real important factor because judges, not all judges recognize safety issues. We have to be sure that we can help them do that. With that, thank you for the opportunity. I wish you all well and happy to answer questions separate and apart from today's hearing.
All right. Thank you very much, Judge.
Yeah, thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this rule?
I've got one question regarding the juror.
Sure. You almost made it.
All right.
No, sorry. I think it might be the same for jurors, and that is for many jurors, at least, they perceive that the bigger threat to them is, if they're in a high-profile case, that the bigger threat to them is once they leave the courthouse. And I know that that having security for them isn't something, you know, obviously we're not going to have police officers in front of their houses for any period of time. But I do know, just in the work that I did and the work that I've done with some other judges around the state, that just giving them the opportunity to at least know that there's a place to call, like to have some sort of protocol in high-profile cases for them to be able to call the police, and so that the police in those counties understand that this case just finished and that these jurors now are going home and that they feel that they're at risk, whether or not they actually are. Did you do any work on that in this committee?
We didn't specifically address that particular aspect of it. What we do address throughout the rule, and it's really an underlying policy, is that we have to look at jurors' safety as something we talk about. The statutes address information that comes in with regard to guard the juror identity and addresses, use of anonymous jurors, that we have jurors by number. Mm-hmm. That's not in the rule. You have to do it on sort of an ad hoc basis within the county. But that's something that can be administered through the county. Just speaking in Waukesha, we give the jurors a flyer that tells them they can call if anything happens. We always escort jurors out to their cars. Depending on the nature of the case, we'd even have them park in a separate area mm-hmm. to be sure that they're safe. We warn, and during court proceedings, we use Standard Instruction 50, both civil and criminal. It talks about the Internet, the things they can do and why they shouldn't be doing it, at least with regard to the case. The biggest concern today, from my standpoint, is the Internet being used to influence juries, not so much specifically, but they talk generally about things, and everybody gets involved in that type of situation. Social media is a dangerous potential.
Thank you.
But it's a good idea. Thank you.
I have a follow-up again to Justice Karofsky's question. Your amendment, Crawford Amendment, does include reference to a jury safety policy.
Yes.
And right after that, since we have you here, it also recommends a procedure whereby each judicial officer may complete and submit a judicial profile for law enforcement purposes and a process for updating on an annual basis. Since you have spent a multitude of hours, days, weeks, months of your life dealing with courthouse security, do you have anything to further this recommendation that a procedure whereby each judicial officer may complete? Any additional information that you want to give to us regarding your thoughts, if not the committee's thoughts, your thoughts, since you know so much about this area, on what kind of a procedure it might be that we're looking for?
Well, certainly completion of the profile is absolutely essential to us individually. Any judicial officer should have it completed, have it on file with the proper authorities. What we have now, if you will, we've got courthouse safety and security. We've got the profile, and we talk about what goes on in the residence. There's this gap here. We have to fill that with some more strenuous policies and guidance. Although we tell judges it's a great idea to fill out the profile, a lot of them don't. A lot of them are concerned with the content and that it's going to be disclosed, medical issues, medicines, that type of thing. I didn't get to it in my presentation, but I'm satisfied that we have it pretty well set that we've inoculated the petition from the standpoint of that it would not be disclosed the way it's currently set up to be, so it's not disclosed to the public. It's safe. But that's a hesitancy that many judges have.
And that's different than the task force that I've put together to
yes.
try to do some additional good work in these areas, right?
Yes, absolutely, and that's Friday.
The rule can't do everything.
Correct. But the profile is good, and just a comment on safety. We had the director's office had an attorney general's opinion letter written with regard to the profile, and it gave us, they said the Supreme, this is back in 2011, it said that the Supreme Court had not ruled on these type of issues. But then the opinion letter goes on to state all the ways that we can inoculate and make bulletproof the profile. And the profile that we now have is based upon that. So I have those rules and the opinions. It's a private letter, so it's never been subject to disclosure.
Good. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Do anything else from my colleagues? All right. Thank you, Judge Bourne.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. We will convene in closed conference about 10 minutes from now.